but I had friends to cheer me up, and that is something. When the first one was released, Christina charmed one of the cooks in the Dauntless Kitchens, and he let us try some cake batter. After the second article, Uriah and Marlene taught me a card game, and we played for 2 hours in the dining hall. Tonight, though, I want to be alone. More than that, I want to remember why I came here, and why I was so determined to stay here that I would jump off a building for it, even before I knew what being dauntless was. I work my fingers through the holes in the net beneath me. I want it to be like the dauntless I saw at school. I want it to be loud and daring and free like them. But they were not members yet. They were just playing at being dauntless. And so was I, when I jumped off that roof. I didn't know what fear was. In the past 4 days, I faced 4 fears. In one, I was tied to a stake, and Peter set a fire beneath my feet. In another, I was drowning again, this time in the middle of an ocean, as the water raged around me. In the third, I watched as my family slowly bled to death. And in the fourth, I was held at gunpoint and forced to shoot them. I know what fear is now. Wind rushes over the lip of the hole and washes over me, and I close my eyes. In my mind, I stand at the edge of the roof again. I undo the buttons of my gray abnegation shirt, exposing my arms, revealing more of my body than anyone else has ever seen. I ball the shirt up and hurl it at Peter's chest. I open my eyes. No, I was wrong. I didn't jump off the roof because I wanted to be like the Dauntless. I jumped off because I already was like them, and I wanted to show myself to them. I wanted to acknowledge a part of myself that abnegation demanded that I hide. I stretch my hands over my head and hook them in the net again. I reach with my toes as far as I can, taking up as much of the net as possible. The night sky is empty and silent, and for the first time in 4 days, so is my mind. I hold my head in my hands and breathe deeply. Today the simulation was the same as yesterday. Someone held me at gunpoint and ordered me to shoot my family. When I lift my head, I see that 4 is watching me. I know the simulation isn't real, I say. You don't have to explain it to me, he replies. You love your family. You don't want to shoot them. Not the most unreasonable thing in the world. And the simulation is the only time I get to see them, I say. Even though he says I don't, I feel like I have to explain why this fear is so difficult for me to face. I twist my fingers together and pull them apart. My nail beds are bitten raw. I've been chewing them as I sleep. I wake to bloody hands every morning. I miss them. You ever just miss your family? 4 looks down. No, he says eventually. I don't, but that's unusual. It is unusual. So unusual it distracts me from the memory of holding a gun to Caleb's chest. What was his family like that he no longer cares about them? I pause with my hand on the doorknob and look back at him. Are you like me? I ask him silently. Are you divergent? Even thinking the word feels dangerous. His eyes hold mine, and as the silent seconds pass, he looks less and less stern. I hear my heartbeat. I have been looking at him too long, but then he has been looking back, and I feel like we are both trying to say something the other can't hear, though I could be imagining it. Too long, and now even longer. My heart even louder, his tranquil eyes swallowing me whole. I push the door open and hurry down the hallway. I shouldn't be so easily distracted by him. I shouldn't be able to think of anything but initiation. The simulations should disturb me more. They should break my mind, as they have been doing to most of the other initiates. Drew doesn't sleep. He just stares at the wall, curled in a ball. Al screams every night from his nightmares and cries into his pillow. My nightmares and chewed fingernails pale by comparison. Al's screams wake me every time, and I stare at the springs above me and wonder what on earth is wrong with me, that I still feel strong when everyone else is breaking down. Is it being divergent that makes me steady, or is it something else? When I get back to the dormitory, I expect to find the same thing I found the day before. a few initiates lying on beds or staring at nothing. Instead, they stand in a group on the other end of the room. Eric is in front of them with a chalkboard in his hands, which is facing the other way, so I can't see what's written on it. I stand next to Will. "What's going on?" I whisper. I hope it isn't another article, because I'm not sure I can handle any more hostility directed at me. "Rankings for stage two," he says. "I thought there weren't any cuts after stage two," I hiss. "There aren't. It's just a progress report, sort of." I nod. The sight of the board makes me feel uneasy, like something is swimming in my stomach. Eric lifts the board above his head and hangs it on the nail. When he steps aside, the room falls silent, and I crane my neck to see what it says. My name is in the first slot. Heads turn in my direction. I follow the list down. Christina and Will are 7th and 9th, respectively. Peter is 2nd, but when I look at the time listed by his name, I realize that the margin between us is conspicuously wide. Peter's average simulation time is 8 minutes. Mine is 2 minutes, 45 seconds. "Nice job, Triss," Will says quietly. I nod, still staring at the board. I should be pleased that I am ranked first, but I know what that means. If Peter and his friends hated me before, they will despise me now. Now I am Edward. It could be my eye next. Or worse. I search for Al's name, and find it in the last slot. The crowd of initiates breaks up slowly, leaving just me, Peter, Will, and Al standing there. I want to console Al, to tell him that the only reason that I'm doing well is that there's something different about my brain. Peter turns slowly, every limb infused with tension. A glare would have been less threatening than the look he gives me, a look of pure hatred. He walks toward his bunk, but at the last second, he whips around and shoves me against a wall, a hand on each of my shoulders. "I will not be outranked by a stiff," he hisses, his face so close to mine I can smell his stale breath. "How did you do it, huh? How the hell did you do it?" He pulls me forward a few inches, and then slams me against the wall again. I clench my teeth to keep from crying out, though the pain from the impact went all the way down my spine. Will grabs Peter by his shirt collar and drags him away from me. "Leave her alone," he says. "Only a coward bullies a little girl." "A little girl?" scoffs Peter, throwing off Will's hand. "Are you blind, or just stupid? She's going to edge you out of the rankings and out of Dauntless, and you're going to get nothing, all because she knows how to manipulate people and you don't. So when you realize that she's out to ruin us all, you let me know." Peter storms out of the dormitory. Molly and Drew follow him, looks of disgust on their faces. "Thanks," I say, nodding to Will. "Is he right?" Will asks quietly. "Are you trying to manipulate us?" "How on earth would I do that?" I scowl at him. "I'm just doing the best I can, like anyone else." "I don't know," he shrugs a little. "By acting weak so we pity you, and then acting tough to psych us out?" "Psych you out?" I repeat. "I'm your friend. I wouldn't do that." He doesn't say anything. I can tell he doesn't believe me. Not quite. "Don't be an idiot, Will," says Christina, hopping down from her bunk. She looks at me without sympathy and adds, "She's not acting." Christina turns and leaves, without banging the door shut. Will follows. I am alone in the room with Al. The first and the last. Al has never looked small before, but he does now, with his shoulders slumped and his body collapsing on itself like crumpled paper. He sits down on the edge of his bed. "Are you all right?" I ask. "Sure," he says. His face is bright red. I look away. Asking him was just a formality. Anyone with eyes could see that Al is not all right. "It's not over," I say. "You can improve your rank if you..." My voice trails off when he looks up at me. I don't even know what I would say to him if I finished my sentence. There is no strategy for stage two. It reaches deep into the heart of who we are, and tests whatever courage is there. "See," he says, "it's not that simple." "I know it's not." I don't think you do, he says, shaking his head. His chin wobbles. For you, it's easy. All of this is easy. That's not true. Yeah, it is. He closes his eyes. You aren't helping me by pretending it isn't. I'm not sure you can help me at all. I feel like I just walked into a downpour, and all my clothes are heavy with water. Like I am heavy and awkward and useless. I don't know if he means that no one can help him, or if I, specifically, can't help him. But I would not be okay with either interpretation. I want to help him. I am powerless to do so. I start to say, meaning to apologize, but for what? For being more dauntless than he is? For not knowing what to say? The tears that had been gathering in his eyes spill over, wetting his cheeks. Want to be alone. I nod and turn away from him. Leaving him is not a good idea, but I can't stop myself. The door clicks into place behind me, and I keep walking. I walk past the drinking fountain and through the tunnels that seem endless the day I got here but now barely register in my mind. This is not the first time I have failed my family since I got here, but for some reason, it feels that way. Every other time I failed, I knew what to do, but chose not to do it. This time, I did not know what to do. Have I lost the ability to see what people need? Have I lost part of myself? I keep walking. I somehow find the hallway I sat in the day Edward left. I don't want to be alone, but I don't feel like I have much of a choice. I close my eyes and pay attention to the cold stone beneath me and breathe the musty underground air. Triss! Someone calls from the end of the hallway. Uriah jogs toward me. Behind him are Lynn and Marlene. Lynn is holding a muffin. Thought I would find you here. He crouches near my feet. I heard you got ranked first. So you just wanted to congratulate me? I smirk. Well, thanks. Someone should, he says. And I figured your friends might not be so congratulatory, since their ranks aren't as high. So quit moping and come with us. I'm going to shoot a muffin off Marlene's head. The idea is so ridiculous I can't stop myself from laughing. I get up and follow Uriah to the end of the hallway, where Marlene and Lynn are waiting. Lynn narrows her eyes at me, but Marlene grins. Why aren't you out celebrating? She asks. You're practically guaranteed a top 10 spot if you keep it up. She's too dauntless for the other transfers, Uriah says. And too abnegation to celebrate, remarks Lynn. I ignore her. Why are you shooting a muffin off Marlene's head? She bet me I couldn't aim well enough to hit a small object from 100 feet, Uriah explains. I bet her she didn't have the guts to stand there as I tried. It works out well, really. The training room where I first fired a gun is not far from my hidden hallway. We get there in under a minute, and Uriah flips on a light switch. It looks the same as the last time I was there. Targets on one end of the room, a table with guns on the other. They just keep these lying around? I ask. Yeah, but they aren't loaded. Uriah pulls up his shirt. There is a gun stuck under the waistband of his pants, right under a tattoo. I stare at the tattoo, trying to figure out what it is, but then he lets his shirt fall. Okay, he says. Go stand in front of a target. Marlene walks away, a skip in her step. You aren't seriously going to shoot at her, are you? I ask Uriah. It's not a real gun, says Lynn quietly. It's got plastic pellets in it. The worst it'll do is sting her face, maybe give her a welt. What do you think we are, stupid? Marlene stands in front of one of the targets and sets the muffin on her head. Uriah squints one eye as he aims the gun. Wait! Calls out Marlene. She breaks off a piece of the muffin and pops it in her mouth. Okay, she shouts the word, garbled by food. She gives Uriah a thumbs up. I take it your ranks were good, I say to Lynn. She nods. Uriah's second. I'm first. Marlene's fourth. You're only first by a hair, says Uriah as he aims. He squeezes the trigger. The muffin falls off Marlene's head. She didn't even blink. We both win, she shouts. You miss your old faction? Lynn asks me. Sometimes, I say. It was calmer, not as exhausting. Marlene picks up the muffin from the ground and bites into it. Uriah shouts, "Gross!" Initiation's supposed to wear us down to who we really are. That's what Eric says, anyway, Lynn says. She arches an eyebrow. Four says it's to prepare us. Well, they don't agree on much. I nod. Four told me that Eric's vision for Dauntless is not what it's supposed to be, but I wish he would tell me exactly what he thinks the right vision is. I get glimpses of it every so often. The Dauntless cheering when I jumped off the building. The net of arms that caught me after ziplining. But they are not enough. Has he read the Dauntless Manifesto? Is that what he believes in? In ordinary acts of bravery? The door to the training room opens. Shauna, Zeke, and Four walk in, just as Uriah fires at another target. The plastic pellet bounces off the center of the target and rolls along the ground.
I thought I heard something in here, says Four. Turns out it's my idiot brother, says Zeke. You're not supposed to be in here after hours. Careful, or Four will tell Eric, and then you'll be as good as scalped.
Uriah wrinkles his nose at his brother and puts the pellet gun away. Marlene crosses the room, taking bites of her muffin, and Four steps away from the door to let us file out. You wouldn't tell Eric, says Lynn, eyeing Four suspiciously.
No, I wouldn't, he says.
As I pass him, he rests his hand on the top of my back to usher me out, his palm pressing between my shoulder blades. I shiver. I hope he can't tell. The others walk down the hallway, Zeke and Uriah shoving each other. Marlene splitting her muffin with Shauna, Lynn marching in front. I start to follow them.
Wait a second, Four says.
I turn toward him, wondering which version of Four I'll see now. The one who scolds me, or the one who climbs Ferris wheels with me? He smiles a little, but the smile doesn't spread to his eyes, which look tense and worried.
You belong here. You know that? He says. You belong with us. It'll be over soon, so just hold on, okay?
He scratches behind his ear and looks away, like he's embarrassed by what he said. I stare at him. I feel my heartbeat everywhere, even in my toes. I feel like doing something bold, but I could just as easily walk away. I'm not sure which option is smarter or better. I'm not sure that I care. I reach out and take his hand. His fingers slide between mine. I can't breathe. I stare up at him, and he stares down at me. For a long moment, we stay that way. Then I pull my hand away and run after Uriah and Lynn and Marlene. Maybe now he thinks I'm stupid or strange. Maybe it was worth it. I get back to the dormitory before anyone else does, and when they start to trickle in, I get into bed and pretend to be asleep. I don't need any of them. Not if they're going to react this way when I do well. If I can make it through initiation, I will be dauntless, and I won't have to see them anymore. I don't need them. But do I want them? Every tattoo I got with them is a mark of their friendship, and almost every time I have laughed in this dark place was because of them. I don't want to lose them, but I feel like I have already. After at least a half hour of racing thoughts, I roll onto my back and open my eyes. The dormitory is dark now. Everyone has gone to bed. Probably exhausted from resenting me so much, I think with a wry smile. As if coming from the most hated faction wasn't enough, now I'm showing them up, too. I get out of bed to get a drink of water. I'm not thirsty, but I need to do something. My bare feet make sticky sounds on the floor as I walk, my hands skimming the wall to keep my path straight. A bulb glows blue above the drinking fountain. I tug my hair over one shoulder and bend over. As soon as the water touches my lips, I hear voices at the end of the hallway. I creep closer to them, trusting the dark to keep me hidden. So far there haven't been any signs of it. Eric's voice. Signs of what?
Well, you wouldn't have seen much of it yet,
someone replies. A female voice. Cold and familiar. But familiar like a dream. Not a real person.
Combat training shows you nothing. The simulations, however, reveal who the divergent rebels are, if there are any. So we will have to examine the footage several times to be sure.
The word divergent makes me go cold. I lean forward, my back pressed to the stone, to see who the familiar voice belongs to.
Don't forget the reason I had Max appoint you, the voice says. Your first priority is always finding them. Always.
I won't forget. I shift a few inches forward, hoping I am still hidden. Whoever that voice belongs to, she is pulling the strings. She is responsible for Eric's leadership position. She is the one who wants me dead.
I tilt my head forward, straining to see them before they turn the corner. Then someone grabs me from behind. I start to scream, but a hand claps over my mouth. It smells like soap, and it's big enough to cover the lower half of my face. I thrash, but the arms holding me are too strong, and I bite down on one of the fingers. Ow! A rough voice cries. Shut up, and keep her mouth covered. That voice is higher than the average male's, and clearer. Peter. A strip of dark cloth covers my eyes, and a new pair of hands ties it at the back of my head. I struggle to breathe. There are at least two hands on my arms, dragging me forward, and one on my back, shoving me in the same direction, and one on my mouth, keeping my screams in. Three people. My chest hurts. I can't resist three people on my own.
Wonder what it sounds like when a stiff begs for mercy,
Peter says with a chuckle. Hurry up. I try to focus on the hand on my mouth. There must be something distinct about it that will make him easier to identify. His identity is a problem I can solve. I need to solve a problem right now, or I will panic. The palm is sweaty and soft. I clench my teeth and breathe through my nose. The soap smell is familiar. Lemongrass and sage. The same smell surrounds Al's bunk. A weight drops into my stomach. I hear the crash of water against rocks. We are near the chasm. We must be above it, given the volume of the sound. I press my lips together to keep from screaming. If we are above the chasm, I know what they intend to do to me.
Lift her up, come on!
I thrash, and their rough skin grates against mine. But I know it's useless. I scream too, knowing that no one can hear me here. I will survive until tomorrow. I will. The hands push me around and up, and slam my spine into something hard and cold. Judging by its width and curvature, it is a metal railing. It is the metal railing. The one that overlooks the chasm. My breath's wheeze and mist touches the back of my neck. The hands force my back to arch over the railing. My feet leave the ground, and my attackers are the only thing keeping me from falling into the water. A heavy hand gropes along my chest.
You sure you're 16, stiff? Doesn't feel like you're more than 12.
The other boy laughs. Bile rises in my throat, and I swallow the bitter taste.
Wait. I think I found something.
His hand squeezes me. I bite my tongue to keep from screaming. More laughter. Al's hand slips from my mouth.
Stop that!
He snaps. I recognize his low, distinct voice. When Al lets go of me, I thrash again and slip down to the ground. This time I bite down as hard as I can on the first arm I find. I hear a scream and clench my jaw harder, tasting blood. Something hard strikes my face. White heat races through my head. It would have been pain if adrenaline wasn't coursing through me like acid. The boy wrenches his trapped arm away from me and throws me to the ground. I bang my elbow against stone and bring my hands up to my head to remove the blindfold. A foot drives into my side, forcing the air from my lungs. I gasp and cough and claw at the back of my head. Someone grabs a handful of my hair and slams my head against something hard. A scream of pain bursts from my mouth, and I feel dizzy. Clumsily, I fumble along the side of my head to find the edge of the blindfold. I drag my heavy hand up, taking the blindfold with it, and blink. The scene before me is sideways and bobs up and down. I see someone running toward us, and someone running away. Someone large. Al.
I grab the railing next to me and haul myself to my feet. Peter wraps a hand around my throat and lifts me up, his thumb wedged under my chin. His hair, which is usually shiny and smooth, is tousled and sticks to his forehead. His pale face is contorted, and his teeth are gritted, and he holds me over the chasm as spots appear on the edges of my vision, crowding around his face, green and pink and blue. He says nothing. I try to kick him, but my legs are too short. My lungs scream for air. I hear a shout, and he releases me. I stretch out my arms as I fall, gasping, and my armpits slam into the railing. I hook my elbows over it and groan. Mist touches my ankles. The world dips and sways around me. And someone is on the pit floor. Drew, screaming. I hear thumps, kicks, groans. I blink a few times and focus as hard as I can on the only face I can see. It is contorted with anger. His eyes are dark blue. Four. I croak. I close my eyes, and hands wrap around my arms, right where they join with the shoulder. He pulls me over the railing and against his chest, gathering me into his arms, easing an arm under my knees. I press my face into his shoulder, and there is a sudden, hollow silence. Chapter 22. I open my eyes to the words, "Fear God alone," painted on a plain white wall. I hear the sound of running water again, but this time it's from a faucet, and not from the chasm. Seconds go by before I see definite edges in my surroundings, the lines of door frame and countertop and ceiling. The pain is a constant throb in my head and cheek and ribs. I shouldn't move. It will make everything worse. I see a blue patchwork quilt under my head, and wince as I tilt my head to see where the water sound is coming from. Four stands in the bathroom with his hands in the sink. Blood from his knuckles turns the sink water pink. He has a cut at the corner of his mouth, but he seems otherwise unharmed. His expression is placid as he examines his cuts, turns off the water and dries his hands with a towel. I have only one memory of getting here, and even that is just a single image. Black ink, curling around the side of a neck, the corner of a tattoo, and the gentle sway that could only mean he was carrying me. He turns off the bathroom light and gets an ice pack from the refrigerator in the corner of the room. As he walks toward me, I consider closing my eyes and pretending to be asleep. But then our eyes meet, and it's too late.
"Your hands,"
I croak.
"My hands are none of your concern," he replies.
He rests his knee on the mattress and leans over me, slipping the ice pack under my head. Before he pulls away, I reach out to touch the cut on the side of his lip, but stop when I realize what I am about to do, my hand hovering.
"What do you have to lose?"
I ask myself. I touch my fingertips lightly to his mouth.
"Triss," he says, speaking against my fingers.
"I'm all right."
"Why were you there?"
I ask, letting my hand drop.
"I was coming back from the control room. I heard a scream."
"What did you do to them?" I say.
"I deposited Drew at the infirmary a half hour ago," he says. "Peter and Al ran. Drew claimed they were just trying to scare you. At least, I think that's what he was trying to say."
"He's in bad shape."
"He'll live," he replies. He adds bitterly, "In what condition, I can't say."
It isn't right to wish pain on other people just because they hurt me first. But white-hot triumph races through me at the thought of Drew in the infirmary, and I squeeze Four's arm.
"Good,"
I say. My voice sounds tight and fierce. Anger builds inside me, replacing my blood with bitter water and filling me, consuming me. I want to break something or hit something, but I am afraid to move, so I start crying instead. Four crouches by the side of the bed and watches me. I see no sympathy in his eyes. I would have been disappointed if I had. He pulls his wrist free and, to my surprise,
rests his hand on the side of my face, his thumb skimming my cheekbone. His fingers are careful.
I could report this, he says.
No, I reply. I don't want them to think I'm scared. He nods. He moves his thumb absently over my cheekbone, back and forth.
I figured you would say that.
You think it would be a bad idea if I sat up?
I'll help you.
Four grips my shoulder with one hand and holds my head steady with the other as I push myself up. Pain rushes through my body in sharp bursts, but I try to ignore it, stifling a groan. He hands me the ice pack.
You can let yourself be in pain, he says. It's just me here.
I bite down on my lip. There are tears on my face, but neither of us mentions or even acknowledges them.
I suggest you rely on your transfer friends to protect you from now on, he says.
I thought I was, I say. I feel Al's hand against my mouth again, and a sob jolts my body forward. I press my hand to my forehead and rock slowly back and forth.
But Al, he wanted you to be the small, quiet girl from Abnegation, Four says softly. He hurt you because your strength made him feel weak. No other reason.
I nod and try to believe him.
The others won't be as jealous if you show some vulnerability, even if it isn't real.
You think I have to pretend to be vulnerable? I ask, raising an eyebrow.
Yes, I do.
He takes the ice pack from me, his fingers brushing mine, and holds it against my head himself. I put my hand down, too eager to relax my arm to object. Four stands up. I stare at the hem of his t-shirt. Sometimes I see him as just another person, and sometimes I feel the sight of him in my gut, like a deep ache.
You're going to want to march into breakfast tomorrow and show your attackers they had no effect on you, he adds. But you should let that bruise on your cheek show, and keep your head down.
The idea nauseates me.
I don't think I can do that,
I say hollowly. I lift my eyes to his.
You have to.
I don't think you get it. Heat rises into my face. They touched me. His entire body tightens at my words, his hand clenching around the ice pack.
Touched you? He repeats, his dark eyes cold.
Not in the way you're thinking. I clear my throat. I didn't realize when I said it how awkward it would be to talk about. But almost. I look away. He is silent and still for so long that eventually I have to say something.
What is it? I don't want to say this, he says. But I feel like I have to. It is more important for you to be safe than right, for the time being. Understand?
His straight eyebrows are drawn low over his eyes. My stomach writhes, partly because I know he makes a good point, but I don't want to admit it, and partly because I want something I don't know how to express. I want to press against the space between us until it disappears.
I nod. But please, when you see an opportunity...
He presses his hand to my cheek, cold and strong, and tilts my head up so I have to look at him. His eyes glint. They look almost predatory.
Ruin them.
I laugh shakily.
You're a little scary, Four.
Do me a favor, he says.
And don't call me that.
What should I call you, then?
Nothing.
He takes his hand from my face.
Yet.
Chapter 23. I don't go back to the dorms that night. Sleeping in the same room as the people who attacked me just to look brave would be stupid. Four sleeps on the floor and I sleep on his bed, on top of the quilt, breathing in the scent of his pillowcase. It smells like detergent, and something heavy, sweet, and distinctly male. The rhythm of his breath slows, and I prop myself up to see if he is asleep. He lies on his stomach with one arm around his head. His eyes are closed, his lips parted. For the first time, he looks as young as he is, and I wonder who he really is.
Who is he when he isn't Dauntless? Isn't an instructor? Isn't four? Isn't anything in particular? Whoever he is, I like him. It's easier for me to admit that to myself now, in the dark, after all that just happened. He is not sweet, or gentle, or particularly kind. But he is smart and brave. And even though he saved me, he treated me like I was strong. That is all I need to know. I watch the muscles in his back expand and contract until I fall asleep. I wake to aches and pains. I cringe as I sit up, holding my ribs, and walk up to the small mirror on the opposite wall. I am almost too short to see myself in it, but when I stand on my tiptoes, I can see my face. As expected, there is a dark blue bruise on my cheek. I hate the idea of slumping into the dining hall like this, but Four's instructions have stayed with me. I have to mend my friendships. I need the protection of seeming weak. I tie my hair in a knot at the back of my head. The door opens, and Four walks in, a towel in hand and his hair glistening with shower water. I feel a thrill in my stomach when I see the line of skin that shows above his belt as he lifts his hand to dry his hair and force my eyes up to his face.
"Hi," I say. My voice sounds tight. I wish it didn't.
He touches my bruised cheek with just his fingertips.
"Not bad," he says.
"How's your head?"
"Fine," I say.
I'm lying. My head is throbbing. I brush my fingers over the bump, and pain prickles over my scalp. It could be worse. I could be floating in the river. Every muscle in my body tightens as his hand drops to my side, where I got kicked. He does it casually, but I can't move.
"And your side?" he asks, his voice low. "Only hurts when I breathe."
He smiles.
"Not much you can do about that.
Peter would probably throw a party if I stopped breathing." "Well," he says,
"I would only go if there was cake."
I laugh, and then wince, covering his hand to steady my rib cage. He slides his hand back slowly, his fingertips grazing my side. When his fingers lift, I feel an ache in my chest. Once this moment ends, I have to remember what happened last night, and I want to stay here with him. He nods a little and leads the way out. "I'll go in first," he says when we stand outside the dining hall. "See you soon, Triss." He walks through the doors and I am alone. Yesterday he told me he thought I would have to pretend to be weak, but he was wrong. I am weak already. I brace myself against the wall and press my forehead to my hands. It's difficult to take deep breaths, so I take short, shallow ones. I can't let this happen. They attacked me to make me feel weak. I can pretend they succeeded to protect myself, but I can't let it become true. I pull away from the wall and walk into the dining hall without another thought. A few steps in, I remember I'm supposed to look like I'm cowering. So I slow my pace and hug the wall, keeping my head down. Uriah, at the table next to Will and Christina's, lifts his hand to wave at me, and then puts it down. I sit next to Will. Al isn't there. He isn't anywhere. Uriah slides into the seat next to me, leaving his half-eaten muffin and half-finished glass of water on the other table. For a second, all three of them just stare at me.
"What happened?"
Will asks, lowering his voice.
I look over his shoulder at the table behind ours. Peter sits there, eating a piece of toast and whispering something to Molly. My hand clenches around the edge of the table. I want him to hurt. But now isn't the time. Drew is missing, which means he's still in the infirmary. Vicious pleasure courses through me at the thought. "Peter, Drew..." I say quietly. I hold my side as I reach across the table for a piece of toast. It hurts to stretch out my hand, so I let myself wince and hunch over. "And..." I swallow. "And Al."
"Oh, God," says Christina, her eyes wide.
"Are you all right?"
Uriah asks. Peter's eyes find mine across the dining hall, and I have to force myself to look away. It brings a bitter taste to my mouth to show him that he scares me, but I have to. Four was right. I have to do everything I can to make sure I don't get attacked again. Not really, I say. My eyes burn, and it's not artifice, unlike the wincing. I shrug. I believe Tori's warning now. Peter, Drew, and Al were ready to throw me into the chasm out of jealousy. What is so unbelievable about the Dauntless leaders committing murder? I feel uncomfortable, like I'm wearing someone else's skin. If I'm not careful, I could die. I can't even trust the leaders of my faction, my new family. But you're just... Uriah purses his lips. It isn't fair. 3 against 1? Yeah. And Peter is all about what's fair. That's why he grabbed Edward in his sleep and stabbed him in the eye. Christina snorts and shakes her head. Al, though? Are you sure, Triss? I stare at my plate. I'm the next Edward. But unlike him, I'm not going to leave. Yeah, I say. I'm sure. It has to be desperation, says Will. He's been acting, I don't know, like a different person, ever since stage 2 started. Then Drew shuffles into the dining hall. I drop my toast, and my mouth drifts open. Calling him bruised would be an understatement. His face is swollen and purple. He has a split lip and a cut running through his eyebrow. He keeps his eyes down on the way to his table, not even lifting them to look at me. I glance across the room at 4. He wears the satisfied smile I wish I had on. Did you do that? Hisses Will. I shake my head. No. Someone, I never saw who, found me right before. I gulp. Saying it out loud makes it worse, makes it real. I got tossed into the chasm. They were going to kill you? Says Christina in a low voice. Maybe. They might have been planning on dangling me over it just to scare me. I lift a shoulder. It worked. Christina gives me a sad look. Will just glares at the table. We have to do something about this, Uriah says in a low voice. What? Like beat them up? Christina grins. Looks like that's been taken care of already. No. That's pain they can get over, replies Uriah. We have to edge them out of the rankings. That will damage their futures. Permanently. 4 gets up and stands between the tables. Conversation abruptly ceases. Transfers. We're doing something different today, he says. Follow me. We stand and Uriah's forehead wrinkles. Be careful, he tells me. Don't worry, says Will. We'll protect her. 4 leads us out of the dining hall and along the paths that surround the pit. Will is on my left. Christina is on my right. I never really said I was sorry, Christina says quietly, for taking the flag when you earned it. I don't know what was wrong with me. I'm not sure if it's smart to forgive her or not, to forgive either of them, after what they said to me when the rankings went up yesterday. But my mother would tell me that people are flawed, and I should be lenient with them. And 4 told me to rely on my friends. I don't know who I should rely on more, because I'm not sure who my true friends are. Uriah and Marlene, who were on my side even when I seemed strong. Or Christina and Will, who have always protected me when I seemed weak. When her wide brown eyes meet mine, I nod. Let's just forget about it. I still want to be angry, but I have to let my anger go. We climb higher than I've gone before, until Will's face goes white whenever he looks down. Most of the time I like heights, so I grab Will's arm like I need his support. But really, I'm lending him mine. He smiles gratefully at me. 4 turns around and walks backward a few steps, backward on a narrow path with no railing.
How well does he know this place?
He eyes Drew, who trudges at the back of the group and says, Pick up the pace, Drew!
It's a cruel joke, but it's hard for me to fight off a smile. That is, until Four's eyes shift to my arm around Will's, and all the humor drains from them. His expression sends a chill through me. Is he jealous?
We get closer and closer to the glass ceiling, and for the first time in days, I see the sun.
Four walks up a flight of metal stairs leading through a hole in the ceiling. They creak under my feet, and I look down to see the pit and the chasm below us. We walk across the glass, which is now a floor rather than a ceiling, through a cylindrical room with glass walls. The surrounding buildings are half collapsed and appear to be abandoned, which is probably why I never noticed the Dauntless compound before. The abnegation sector is also far away. The Dauntless mill around the glass room, talking in clusters. At the edge of the room, two Dauntless fight with sticks, laughing when one of them misses and hits only air. Above me, two ropes stretch across the room, one a few feet higher than the other. They probably have something to do with the daredevil stunts the Dauntless are famous for. Four leads us through another door. Beyond it is a huge, dank space, with graffitied walls and exposed pipes. The room is lit by a series of old-fashioned fluorescent tubes with plastic covers. They must be ancient.
This, says Four, his eyes bright in pale light, is a different kind of simulation, known as the Fear Landscape. It has been disabled for our purposes, so this isn't what it will be like the next time you see it. Behind him, the word Dauntless is spray-painted in red artistic lettering on a concrete wall. Through your simulations, we have stored data about your worst fears. The Fear Landscape accesses that data and presents you with a series of virtual obstacles. Some of the obstacles will be fears you previously faced in your simulations. Some may be new fears. The difference is that you are aware, in the Fear Landscape, that it is a simulation. So you will have all your wits about you as you go through it.
That means that everyone will be like Divergent in the Fear Landscape. I don't know if that's a relief, because I can't be detected, or a problem, because I won't have the advantage.
Four continues. The number of fears you have in your landscape varies according to how many you have.
How many fears will I have? I think of facing the crows again and shiver, though the air is warm.
I told you before that the third stage of initiation focuses on mental preparation, he says.
I remember when he said that, on the first day, right before he put a gun to Peter's head. I wish he had pulled the trigger.
That is because it requires you to control both your emotions and your body. To combine the physical abilities you learned in stage one with the emotional mastery you learned in stage two. To keep a level head.
One of the fluorescent tubes above Four's head twitches and flickers.
Four stops scanning the crowd of initiates and focuses his stare on me. Next week, you will go through your fear landscape as quickly as possible in front of a panel of Dauntless leaders. That will be your final test, which determines your ranking for Stage 3. Just as Stage 2 of initiation is weighted more heavily than Stage 1, Stage 3 is weighted heaviest of all. Understood? We all nod. Even Drew, who makes it look painful.
If I do well in my final test, I have a good chance of making it into the top 10, and a good chance of becoming a member. Becoming Dauntless. The thought makes me almost giddy with relief.
You can get past each obstacle in one of two ways. Either you find a way to calm down enough that the simulation registers a normal, steady heartbeat, or you find a way to face your fear, which can force the simulation to move on. One way to face a fear of drowning is to swim deeper, for example. Four shrugs. So I suggest that you take the next week to consider your fears and develop strategies to face them.
That doesn't sound fair, says Peter. What if one person only has 7 fears and someone else has 20? That's not their fault.
Four stares at him for a few seconds and then laughs.
Do you really want to talk to me about what's fair?
The crowd of initiates parts to make way for him as he walks toward Peter, folds his arms and says, in a deadly voice,
I understand why you're worried, Peter.
The events of last night certainly prove that you are a miserable coward.
Peter stares back, expressionless.
So now we all know, says Four quietly, that you are afraid of a short, skinny girl from abnegation.
His mouth curls in a smile. Will puts his arm around me. Christina's shoulders shake with suppressed laughter. And somewhere within me, I find a smile too.
When we get back to the dorm that afternoon, Al is there.
Will stands behind me and holds my shoulders, lightly, as if to remind me that he's there.
Christina edges closer to me. Al's eyes have shadows beneath them, and his face is swollen from crying. Pain stabs my stomach when I see him. I can't move. The scent of lemongrass and sage, once pleasant, turns sour in my nose.
Tris, says Al, his voice breaking. Can I talk to you?
Are you kidding? Will squeezes my shoulders. You don't get to come near her ever again.
I won't hurt you. I never wanted to.
Al covers his face with both hands.
I just want to say that I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't know what's wrong with me. Please, forgive me. Please.
He reaches for me like he's going to touch my shoulder or my hand, his face wet with tears.
Somewhere inside me is a merciful, forgiving person. Somewhere there is a girl who tries to understand what people are going through, who accepts that people do evil things and that desperation leads them to darker places than they ever imagined. I swear she exists, and she hurts for the repentant boy I see in front of me. But if I saw her, I wouldn't recognize her.
Stay away from me, I say quietly. My body feels rigid and cold, and I am not angry. I am not hurt. I am nothing.
I say, my voice low,
never come near me again.
Our eyes meet. His are dark and glassy. I'm nothing.
If you do, I swear to God, I will kill you.
I say,
you coward.
Chapter 24
Tris. In my dream, my mother says my name. She beckons to me, and I cross the kitchen to stand beside her. She points to the pot on the stove, and I lift the lid to peek inside. The beady eye of a crow stares back at me, its wing feathers pressed to the side of the pot, its fat body covered with boiling water.
Dinner, she says.
Tris! I hear again. I open my eyes. Christina stands next to my bed, her cheeks streaked with mascara-tinted tears.
It's Al, she says.
Come on.
Some of the other initiates are awake, and some aren't.
Christina grabs my hand and pulls me out of the dormitory. I run barefoot over the stone floor, blinking clouds from my eyes, my limbs still heavy with sleep.
Something terrible has happened. I feel it with every thump of my heart.
It's Al.
We run across the pit floor, and then Christina stops.
A crowd has gathered around the ledge, but everyone stands a few feet from one another, so there is enough space for me to maneuver past Christina and around a tall, middle-aged man to the front.
Two men stand next to the ledge, hoisting something up with ropes.
They both grunt from the effort, heaving their weight back so the ropes slide over the railing, and then reaching forward to grab again. A huge, dark shape appears above the ledge, and a few dauntless rush forward to help the two men haul it over. The shape falls with a thud on the pit floor. A pale arm, swollen with water, flops onto the stone. A body. Christina pulls herself tight to my side, clinging to my arm. She turns her head into my shoulder and sobs,
but I can't look away. A few of the men turn the body over, and the head flops to the side. The eyes are open and empty. Dark. Doll's eyes. And the nose has a high arch, a narrow bridge, a round tip. The lips are blue. The face itself is something other than human. Half corpse and half creature. My lungs burn. My next breath rattles on the way in.
Ow. One of the initiates, says someone behind me. What happened?
Same thing that happens every year, someone else replies. He pitched himself over the ledge.
Don't be so morbid. Could have been an accident.
They found him in the middle of the chasm. You think he tripped over his shoelace and, whoopsies, just stumbled 15 feet forward? Christina's hands get tighter and tighter around my arm. I should tell her to let go of me. It's starting to hurt. Someone kneels next to Al's face and pushes his eyelids shut, trying to make it look like he's sleeping, maybe. Stupid.
Why do people want to pretend that death is sleep? It isn't. It isn't.
Something inside me collapses. My chest is so tight, suffocating, can't breathe. I sink to the ground, dragging Christina down with me. The stone is rough under my knees. I hear something, a memory of sound. Al sobs, his screams at night. Should have known. Still can't breathe. I press both palms to my chest and rock back and forth to free the tension in my chest. When I blink, I see the top of Al's head as he carries me on his back to the dining hall. I feel the bounce of his footsteps. He is big and warm and clumsy. No, was. That is death. Shifting from is to was. I wheeze. Someone has brought a large black bag to put the body in. I can tell that it will be too small. A laugh rises in my throat and flops from my mouth, strained and gurgling. Al's too big for the body bag. What a tragedy. Halfway through the laugh, I clamp my mouth shut, and it sounds more like a groan. I pull my arm free and stand, leaving Christina on the ground. I run. Here you go, Tori says. She hands me a steaming mug that smells like peppermint. I hold it with both hands, my fingers prickling with warmth. She sits down across from me. When it comes to funerals, the Dauntless don't waste any time. Tori said they want to acknowledge death as soon as it happens. There are no people in the front room of the tattoo parlor, but the pit is crawling with people, most of them drunk. I don't know why that surprises me. At home, a funeral's a somber occasion. Everyone gathers to support the deceased's family, and no one has idle hands, but there is no laughter, or shouting, or joking. And the abnegation don't drink alcohol, so everyone is sober. It makes sense that funerals would be the opposite here.
Drink it, she says. It will make you feel better, I promise.
I don't think tea is the solution, I say slowly. But I sip it anyway. It warms my mouth and my throat and trickles into my stomach. I didn't realize how deeply cold I was until I wasn't anymore.
Better is the word I used, not good.
She smiles at me, but the corners of her eyes don't crinkle like they usually do.
I don't think good will happen for a while.
I bite my lip.
How long?
I struggle for the right words.
How long did it take for you to be okay again? After your brother?
Don't know. She shakes her head. Some days I feel like I'm still not okay. Some days I feel fine. Happy even. It took me a few years to stop plotting revenge, though.
Why did you stop? I ask.
Her eyes go vacant as she stares at the wall behind me. She taps her fingers against her leg for a few seconds and then says,
I don't think of it as stopping. More like I'm waiting for my opportunity.
She comes out of her daze and checks her watch.
Time to go, she says.
I pour the rest of my tea down the sink.
When I lift my hand from the mug, I realize that I'm shaking. Not good.